Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. $44 billion, that is a lot of money to buy a social media platform. But that's just what the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, did this week. And the ramifications of this purchase and promise to take Twitter private will have reverberations around the world of social media and the world itself. After all, an entire generation of people, maybe two, are more familiar with getting their news from Twitter than perhaps the evening news. And it's now under the influence of one man, a very ideal logical one at that. Not to mention, the purchase of Twitter has sparked another debate over whether Musk will move the company out of San Francisco and California altogether, having moved parts of Tesla's production out of state over what he calls an unfriendly business climate. To help us better understand the move, we're joined by UC Davis professor and social media expert, Dr. Andy Jones. Good morning, Dr. Jones.
Good morning, Vicky. Very happy to be here.
So first off, if you're not on Twitter or even not even a fan of social media, why should you care about Elon Musk buying Twitter?
Well, it could be argued that Twitter is the most influential medium out there. It has more followers than any newspaper, and more people are on Twitter than watch any particular TV show or news program. And as a result, there are a great number of influential people, people who make policy, people who cover such policies in the news, who use Twitter as a means of communication and profligation of their ideas and of the discoveries that they're making and the opinions and agendas that they would like to share. And so we are all in some way or another affected by Twitter as a mode of communication, whether it's interpersonal or spread out to huge audiences, whether we ourselves are on the social medium or not.
So regardless if you have that handle, how does Twitter compare to other social media platforms? I mean, Facebook, Instagram?
I'd say that one of the big differences is that typically with Facebook, we are communicating to an audience that is largely curtailed by the people who are in our friend groups, and then people sometimes who participate in the same sort of specific interests that we have through pages and groups that we follow. But Twitter, by contrast, although it's not hasn't been as profitable as Facebook and Instagram, it is much more easily shared. And this is in part because of the short length of a tweet. And it's a place where we can go to find information from strangers and share information with strangers and spark conversations with people who matter and people who are just curious. And so there's a potential for spread and a potential for interaction of ideas that is not really possible in these other social media. Elon Musk called Twitter the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated. And I think a lot of people who spend time on Twitter or recognize its importance for policymakers, but also people who have participated in different social effects and social presentations of ideas broadly. And one thinks of Arab Spring or the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, that Twitter has been a crucial mode of communication of those ideas and those causes.
Given that you're a professor at UC Davis with a focus on writing and literature classes, what had you dive into the world of social media?
Well, in addition to all that, I'm also the Academic Associate Director for Academic Technology Services, which means that I help faculty improve their teaching through the use of different instructional technology tools. And media has been an important part of that. All of us have been thinking about how it is that we make our classes relevant to our students. A lot of times we have to meet them where we are rather than where we would want them to be. Many faculty grew up reading a daily newspaper. I was raised in Washington, D.C., and so I pretty much learned to read from the Washington Post, now owned by Jeff Bezos. But most of our students, as you said at the top, find their information from something like The Daily Show or from Twitter. And therefore, the sort of information that they encounter is often determined by groups that they've already joined, groups of friends or groups of people who agree with them politically. So it's important in classes like writing, communications, that we have an understanding of how our students negotiate the world of information and news so that we can make our assignments, our classes relevant to them, but also teach them some of the principles to make smart choices and not fall for scams and logical fallacies.
I guess, how did it strike you when you read the news that Elon Musk had enough funding and investments to essentially buy Twitter, especially going off of, you mentioned Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post. I think he's like the second richest man in the world. What does that signal to you?
Yeah, Elon Musk is the richest man in the world, and he's buying Twitter. Some of our other richest people own Time Magazine and the Wall Street Journal. Sheldon Adelson, we might remember in 2016 or so, bought the Las Vegas Review Journal and immediately changed some of its editorial policies. So these are really valid concerns. And when I first read this, I thought of it in these particular contexts of, you know, what's happening when there's a concentration of not only financial power, but media power in these American oligarchs, if you want to call them that. But also, it gave me concerns because of this particular man buying this particular medium. Elon Musk has trolled people. He has put silly jokes up on Twitter. For instance, just yesterday, he said that next he's going to buy Coca-Cola and put the cocaine back in. And so it's difficult always to take him seriously, but his quirks, his individual enthusiasms may now shape this public discourse, depending on the sort of control that he's able to wield over it.
Why would some people be excited that Twitter is going private with Musk as the new owner?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Musk talks a lot about free speech, and he has said that he would loosen up some of the content rules in the name of free speech. And you know, as Californians, I think many of us appreciate safeguards against, say, promoting misinformation about medical topics or public safety topics, or about the very foundation of our democracy and the results of a free and fair election. And if Musk's changes lead to a free-for-all, some people would have deep concerns about that. Others would say, oh, finally, we have been unmuzzled as Twitter users, and now we can say what we want. So that's one idea, is just loosening up those content rules. And then he's also promised a number of changes. He's long before he was talking about buying Twitter, he complained that there's no edit button, that if you put up an Instagram post or a Facebook post, you can go back and edit it. And that's not possible for a tweet, as many of us who have stuck typos in our tweets. And then it starts to go viral. It's embarrassing that we are displaying to the world that we don't know how to spell the word the or what have you.
Or there.
Yeah, for sure. And as a writing teacher, you can imagine how painful that is for me in particular. So he's promised an edit button. He's also said that he will open up Twitter's algorithm to the public. In some ways, this is a nod to transparency. In other ways, it might make it easier for bots to game the system now that they understand exactly how the algorithms work, such as the algorithms that determine what pops up first when you log into Twitter. However, Musk has also said that he will launch a war on these bot armies. And these are the sort of bots that also played a role in the 2016 election, many experts say. And so I think all of us who have spent time on hold would love to spend more time talking to people and less time talking to robots. And so if Elon Musk could do that, that would be very exciting to many of the people who lament the onslaught of information and advertising that that we find on Twitter.
Given the fact that you brought up movements that have really taken off because of Twitter, from Black Lives Matter to Me Too, which also translates into We Said Enough, specifically in California at the state capitol, does the sale of Twitter, the fact that I know it may potentially move, or, you know, there's some rumblings of that, but currently it's in San Francisco, it's in the Bay Area, it's in California, in a state that is considered at least politically progressive when compared to the rest of the country, does this sale put Twitter at odds with California values?
Well, I don't know if it puts it at odds with our values yet. It will depend in part on what Musk is able to do, what new policies he institutes. I think there are certainly employees at Twitter and people in Twitter leadership should be concerned that it would make sense that a number of them would lose their jobs because Musk has complained openly about, for instance, that the stock price of Twitter is not much greater than its IPO of 10 years ago, whereas Facebook has grown at something like 256% during that same time period, or since its IPO, I should say. But to get back to your question, I think that there will absolutely be changes at Twitter. I think that they will probably initially be slow. We know that this process will take much of a year, that there are regulations in Europe, for example, which have even tighter regulations on free speech than we have here in the United States with our First Amendment, that European leaders have said that there will be no loosening of restrictions on, for instance, hate speech in Europe just because one particular man has purchased Twitter. There are concerns about, for instance, Musk not upsetting leaders in China, because China is such an important market for Tesla, especially in the future. Even since Musk has announced the successful purchase of Twitter, Tesla has lost $125 billion in value because investors are predicting that Musk will have to sell a lot of Tesla stock in order to fund this purchase, and even that he might be distracted from the work that he's doing with Tesla and SpaceX and the Boring Company, which largely creates tunnels, that he'll be distracted by Twitter. He tweets a lot. He's already distracted by Twitter, and that this may keep him from helming these other companies successfully as he's done so far.
Professor Jones, thank you so much for helping unpack all of that.
Thank you, Vicky. It's been a pleasure.
And that is Dr. Andy Jones, a UC Davis writing professor, journalist, and social media expert. Up next, UC Davis Health explains a new initiative for organ transplant equity. We'll learn the historical gaps that leave the most underserved off donor waiting lists. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed, Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Health starts at home and is shaped by society, how we take care of ourselves, as well as our views on what is healthy or the latter. In the space of medical care, health also involves trust. And historically, we've learned to lean in or become skeptical through generations of family, culture, and in some of the most vulnerable communities, neglect. All of these influences have far-reaching ripple effects. Today, we're going to spend some time learning the consequences when it comes to life-saving organ transplants and donors. It might be a pink dot on your driver's license. One person can save up to 8 lives, improve the lives of 75 others. But the hard reality is 17 people die each day waiting for a transplant. And out of a current wait list nationally of 100,000 plus, 60% are people of color. All of this is according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I can really go on and on with numbers and statistics, but numbers often fall short because honestly, for many of us, organ donation only resonates with us when we're confronted with that dire need for ourselves or someone we love. So to help us better understand the challenges and hopeful solutions firsthand, we're joined by Dr. Martin Caderas, a medical director in the area of heart failure and heart transplant cardiology at UC Davis Health. Welcome, Dr. Caderas.
Hello, good morning, Vicky. Thank you very much for inviting me to your program.
You're very welcome. You're leading a new initiative at UC Davis to increase organ transplant equity. Before we dive into the specifics of all of that, in your more than 20-year career in the medical field, what do you see firsthand that was missing in connecting people to understanding the importance of organ donations?
Thank you. I think this you make a really very important question. Yes, everything is about what people think what is missing for them. And something that is key is health education, right? So health education is key for our first or initial contact with the health system, our contact with prevention of disease, and to access to proper care. And so to access to a waiting list or to register as a donor organ. So health education, I think, is that key link that a lot of times is missing, and that we see a lot of patients that come with very advanced disease that if we have intervened earlier in a way that was more meaningful at the individual level, we would have done much, much more advanced than many very advanced, sophisticated treatments do nowadays.
Right. I mean, you're hitting home that the consequences of this, you know, not having preventative care and not having access or even knowledge of care, it manifests into chronic or severe health problems. And especially when offering treatment in the field of heart diseases, your field, I mean, how often did you come across patients and just think like this could have been preventable? What have those conversations been like?
Wow, you hit in a very important point. I mean, that conversation is really very, very often. You know, estimate says that about 50 to even 80% of cardiovascular disease is preventable. So can you imagine how many people that we currently treat with, for example, coronary artery disease, hypertension, that has implications also in the health of other organs like the kidneys, right? So everything is linked. So it's a large proportion of the disease that we see today could have been just prevented because of better health education, better health behavior.
How does that make you feel, given that you're in a field of helping people feel better and treating diseases and conditions?
So, I mean, I think this in some ways is sad. And on the other hand, I see that there is always an opportunity, right? So it's and that how I think it's in a place where everybody has a role on improving that health. So on being able just to promote a collective effort in this. And when I say sad is because a lot of times, you know, I see patients, I mean, what we do is heart failure, heart transplant, which is replacing the heart or inserting mechanical heart pumps. So for patients with end-stage heart disease, and you see this is a patient who suddenly, for example, had chest pain, right? And he said, oh, I want to continue work. I want to still continue working and not seek attention because, you know, it's just a chest pain. And that chest pain ended up being a heart attack. Mm-hmm. That if we have got that patient right on time into the emergency room, for example, that heart attack would have been prevented. So sometimes there's patients that present with massive heart attacks that require like a lot of devices, technology that needs drugs, tents that needs to be placed into these patients. And all that could have just been prevented with, you know, proper awareness about what are the symptoms of heart disease, what to do if I have heart disease. Very simple things, very simple concept. And then be on medication and do the proper adjustments in our lifestyle in order just to prevent that from happening.
Well, that leads me to organ transplants, because that's often a worst case scenario. What is the problem that you're trying to solve with this new initiative? It's called the Pluralist Project at UC Davis Health.
So what we thought when we started to think about this is, you know, for years we have been talking about the growth of the transplant waiting list. And this is like an endless problem because it continues to grow and grow. And the way that we have been approaching this in some way, you know, has been the same. And it's always the same, is how we're going to change things and how we make significant change if we keep doing this, if we keep doing things the same way that we have been doing them yesterday. So we felt that now with a lot of tools, previous cases with social media, with data that is more available, just to understand exactly what's going on in the community, what are the community needs, and tools that we can use in order to deliver the right information to the right people in the way that they can interpret it, that could be, could have a significant impact in the health. Like, for example, if you're today working on a field in California, what is the likelihood that you're going to receive the proper information that you need to take care of yourself properly, or that to go and become an organ donor? For example, and not long time ago, we went to a school, right? And we were talking about organ donation. What we found out was that the real problems that kids had at school was not about organ donation, about transplantation. It was about drugs. It was about behavioral problems at home, alcohol, and child pregnancy. So organ donation was very low in their priorities. So what it highlighted for us and what shed light was that we need to understand each community in order to be able to approach the problems in the context that they live. So there's not a one-size-fits-all solution, and that is what technology allows us today. So we can understand what's going on in the community, what the problems that they have, and working with them, because that's something that has just to emerge from the community, we can design the intervention in a way that is relevant to them. Mm. So, I mean, one of the things,
how crucial, this is a question that we were having, how crucial is diversity in organ donors and why? Because matches between donors and recipients, they can, of different ethnicities, can happen and are common, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, you bring a very important point. You know, like as we are, let's say, similar or different as we see, right, like physically, externally, with people that is like taller, shorter, female, males, we see people that have different racial and ethnic components. So the same thing happened to our organs and our immune system. So there's a lot of variability, a lot of variation. So the better that we're able to mimic the organ of the recipient with the donor, the more likely that heart or that organ is going to have an easier life inside their host. Mm-hmm. So that similarity is very important. So when we have in the waiting list, for example, a much larger proportion of people that are, for example, from an African-American background, but the proportion of donors that we that are available is lower. Mm. So in a certain way, we want to enrich the population so we can have like a similar proportion in able to be able just to make the donor pool like more diverse, and that way be able just to have better matches. And that is associated with better success on the long term.
Dr. Carderas, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No, thank you very much for having us and for bringing this important issue to the community. Thank you.
Dr. Martin Carderas is a medical director in the area of heart failure and heart transplant cardiology at UC Davis Health. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're going to continue the conversation of organ transplants and donors and equity with Rhonda Smith, executive director of the California Black Health Network and the nonprofit's efforts to advance health equity for all Black Californians. Good morning, Rhonda.
Good morning, Vicki. How are you?
Doing great, thank you. You wrote a piece, it's quite serendipitous, on this very topic this week in Capital Weekly. What inspired you to write the article, and what's missing from this conversation?
Yes, so talk about serendipity. Right at this very moment, I was scheduled to be in a meeting talking about how we can actually set up a real estate on our website to actually have information, educational information, and information to dispel some of the myths about organ donation and transplantation, and then offer people an opportunity to register. So it's also very serendipitous. So, but I think, you know, for us, it's important to really think about all aspects of the work that we can do to decrease the disparity in terms of life expectancy. Like, we know just in general here in California that the Black population has a life expectancy of about 5.5 years less than the state average. And that was before COVID. We know that COVID has really exacerbated that disparity, not only here in California, but across the country. And so when we try to focus on what we can do, we're looking at everything from literally birth to death in the work that we are focused on at the California Black Health Network. So we're looking at things, you know, conditions like maternal health and infant mortality, chronic diseases, including hypertension, diabetes, and so forth, even cancer disparities, rare diseases like lupus and sickle cell, and even some end of life issues, which is where transplantation can come in. So if someone is confronted with, a life-threatening condition, like if they're on dialysis and, the only other option for them to resume a normal life is a kidney transplant, then we want to make sure that people are aware that that is a potential option for them and that their chances of a successful transplantation can actually happen. Mm-hmm. So that is essentially what we're aiming to do with our work.
You know, when looking at these numbers and data, I mean, each number is a human being. It's personal. I mean, who are the people that you've encountered in your line of work or even in your life that really highlights the reality that more needs to be done?
Yes. So, I think Dr. Carderas mentioned this. When we talk about, accessibility to these resources, and education and prevention, it becomes challenging when we look at underserved and under-resourced communities and the factors that contribute to poor outcomes. And so when we think about social determinants of health, those factors are very influential and have a direct impact on what we see in terms of health outcomes and health disparities. So prevention, yes, can be a key factor, but if you live in a community where you don't have access to healthy, nutritious food, or if you don't have safe places to exercise or walk, it becomes a challenge when we talk about that. So we encounter a lot of people, unfortunately, even here in California, in certain communities where that is their life and challenges that they face every day. I think he also alluded to, when we think about transplantation and have that conversation, there are so many other things that people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis just to make it from one day to the next or just to provide for their family. So it's not necessarily something that's high on the priority list, as he mentioned, for families to talk about or think about when it comes to, or not until it comes to, you know, a life-threatening or a very significant life event that happens.
Finally, when it comes to solutions, Dr. Cadeiras mentioned this as well. You know, often, like, and you alluded to this when talking about organ donations, transplantations, it often falls off, you know, the conversation list when you're talking about other health issues that impact communities. What is being done on the front end to start that conversation and to open acceptance and even knowledge to becoming an organ donor?
Right. So I think the number one thing there, well, it's number one and number two, education and trust. And we know that when we talk specifically about the Black community, that there has been historically trust or mistrust of the medical community because of some of the atrocities that have happened in the past. And we have plenty of stories and evidence that kind of validates a concern that people have about medical research and also organ donation. And so I think it becomes, on the front end, what we can do is really provide the evidence-based information and education to help people really understand that there are guardrails in place now that prevent those type of things from happening going forward in the medical community and as part of research, but also that the misconceptions that people have about transplantation is important to also address in the work that we do as part of building that trust and improving health literacy around this particular issue. So we work with, you know, communities and organizations within those communities, like churches, other civic organizations. So really trying to get to where people live, play, eat, work, pray, and so forth, to get information out, not just about this, but about, you know, general information about what people can do to really become more proactive about their health and wellness and prevent the conditions such as diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes and heart disease and so forth, from happening.
Rhonda Smith is the executive director of the California Black Health Network. Thank you for spending time with us this morning, Rhonda.
Thank you, Vicki. It was a pleasure being here.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. All right, sit back. We're taking you on a musical journey to round out the hour, and we're starting off with a music festival comeback. After a pandemic-muted 2 years, the Soul Bloom R&B Festival returns to Sacramento this weekend, and it's been upgraded with not one, but 2 days and an all-female headliners even at that, including recent Grammy Award-winning artist Jasmine Sullivan. CAP Radio News editor Chris Hooks joins us with a warm-up of what to expect. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Vicki. How's it going?
It's going good. So every festival has its own culture and style. What stands out to you about Soul Bloom?
You know, I was actually thinking about this yesterday as I was trying to, like, put together a few clips for you guys to play on Insight. And I think I came to the conclusion that if you've ever seen the show Insecure on HBO, that the music that's played at Soul Bloom is basically the soundtrack to that show. It's the soundtrack for, like, mid-20s, mid to mid-30-year-olds, you know, the music that they listen to as they're growing into adulthood, things like that. That and it's really perfect, especially for like this time of year, for just the music, the vibes, the culture, the everything, during like late April, mid-May, when it's cool but a little hot, the sun's just coming out, things like that. It's really perfect, honestly. That's probably how I would explain it.
Yeah, I love it. It's kind of like a coming of age, even with the perfect season going from like spring to summer. The origins of the festival, they're really hyper local. They're rooted in Sacramento. I mean, how did this festival come about?
Yeah, so I mean, you got to sort of look back to 2015, 2016, we had TBD Fest, which was in West Sac. Was pretty big, that sort of shut down, but for a while there we didn't really have a music festival that was rooted in, you know, non-Aftershock, which also is a great festival that's this year, hard rock, and other heavy metal things and stuff like that is Aftershock, but we didn't really have a music festival that was for a specific audience like this, for R&B listeners, for people who were a little younger in age who really loved this sort of culture. 2018 came and we had a small, very, very small version of Soul Bloom at Cesar Chavez. 2019, same thing. And, you know, it started to really, really grow and grow. Like you said, local folks who put it on, they're from Sacramento and they really know what people here like to listen to, because they've been putting on parties and events and shows for years in Sacramento. So it's really how it came about.
You know, when I think of R&B, I can think of like Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding, but I go back to like elementary school, like at Warehouse, you know, when I bought CDs. And for me, it was like TLC, Crazy, Sexy, Cool. When did R&B start for you?
around the same time, actually. I mean, TLC was... Crazy Sexy Cool was an incredible album for me, even though I was like 5 or 6 when that album came out. I just remember like listening to a lot of R&B with my cousins, my mom when we're cleaning on the weekends, my grandma when we're cleaning her house on the weekends, just especially at my mom's house, listening. She'll throw on gospel as well, but on Sundays, but like on Saturdays, if we're cleaning, throwing on Mary J. Blige. Like, that's still one of my favorite artists all time. Still listen to her albums to this day, the older ones obviously, but yeah, that I think that's where R&B began for me.
All right, we're gonna you very graciously curated a list of who we can look forward to. So let's start off with the first artist, Sid Smino. Am I saying that correct?
Sid featuring Smino is this song. So Sid is actually, both of these people who are on this song will be performing at Soul Bloom, which is why I sort of chose this track. It's also, I believe, Sid's first single off of her new album that just came out a month or so ago.
Maybe you should stay the night. Promise it'll change your life. Call it giving thanks for life. Wonder we can make a life. Say I gotta do you right, girl. You ain't gotta tell me twice. Then we'll be your type. You just had to realize that. Seems like we're on the right track. Keep it up, you'll keep me coming right back. Yeah, you know I'm trying to wipe that. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, sometimes when I think of R&B, I think of something a little slower or sultry, but you can really get down to that. That's a good beat.
Yeah. And Sid has a lot of slower music as well. Obviously, I didn't want to play a whole bunch of slower music, R&B music here. But she also has a lot of upbeat music like that as well, which I think is really, really good for the vibes and the culture of Soul Bloom. So.
All right. Who's next?
Next is Sir. He is a singer from the LA group TDE, which has Kendrick Lamar, Schoolboy Q, SZA, and some others. This is You Can't Save Me.
Mm-hmm.
actually takes me back. I get more of a retro feel to this song.
Yeah, his voice too. It's so raspy, and it's so good. But you know, had to bring some a little slower R&B for you there to bring you back. So,
all right, the third and the last. Who's your final pick?
All right, so Thundercat is an incredible bass player. Not a huge singer, but just an incredible musician overall. And this is his probably most popular song. So.
Brought the variety, Chris. Thank you.
I tried.
All right. Finally, aside from the music, what are you looking forward to most?
It sounds weird because I'm still very I'm still very cautious about being around a lot of people, but being around a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I've been to a music festival. I went to my first concert since the pandemic. Earlier this month to Tyler, the Creator, and that was great. So just, I mean, being around a lot of people, listening to a lot of music, and yeah, that's, I think, what I'm really looking forward to the most. And also being in the photo pit, taking pictures.
Yeah, listening on Spotify and watching on YouTube is great, but it can only do so much.
All right.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Vicky.
Chris Hook is Cap Radio's news editor. Soul Bloom kicks off this weekend at Discovery Park in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. You're off the lease, run me back east. No more buffing up the hood, yeah, I ain't even got. All right, we're going to keep the good times going. Every Thursday this month, we've been celebrating NPR's 2022 Tiny Desk Contest entrants from across Northern California. Myself, modern music director and Hey Listen host Nick Bruner, as well as singer Tara Lopez from Rituals of Mind, shared all of our favorites. And now we welcome Jasmine Vu with Cap Radio's Member Engagement. Jasmine selected their Tiny Desk favorites from across Northern California and joins us with more. Good morning, Jasmine.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. Let's take a step back and start when Nick Bruner approached you and asked you to help with this year's contest. What does Tiny Desk mean to you?
I grew up watching a lot of the Tiny Desk performances. Favorites of mine were Megan Thee Stallion, Mitski, her moments singing straight into the guitar. Absolutely iconic. And then I think a couple years ago, my religion teacher from high school posted a Tiny Desk concert of Chai, which is a Japanese indie rock band. And I was like, oh my God, you live in Boston now and we share the same music taste? You taught me what Sikhism was. So Tiny Desk to me is just a lot of connections. It's like professional connections. A lot of artists get picked up and noticed through the contest, but it's also connecting fellow listeners,
yeah,
and artists.
I completely agree. Tiny Desk got me through like 2020. All right, so let's get to your first pick, Arson Wales. Let's take a quick listen and then we'll unpack it.
It's like a poison underneath every fading memory, imitating what
I think it's so appropriate that they're from cool California.
Right?
There's a cool dive bar there. I'm pretty sure they probably play there. Mm-hmm. I love a comment where it says, like, you can float away to this music.
Yeah, I think the song is called Zephyr and Sycophant, and you can really hear like that breezy, airy quality. It makes you feel like you are like on a tailwind. You can hear, I think, like shades of Fleetwood Mac in the vocals, which is a little bit of a psychedelic touch. I feel very carried and sort of uplifted by how steady the bass line is, and listening to everything swell behind it is just very, very engaging for me. I feel almost a little like hypnotized. The band has two other songs out. They actually started as a cover band, and then in 2020, you know, live music shuttered. You kind of had to like figure out what to do in the meantime. A lot of people were like, let's start a band. Only a few people really like actually started a band. And I feel like having to adapt and sort of like pick up shades of other artists as a cover band really lends to like a what I like to call a genre fluidity.
Yeah.
And I really see that in this song, and I really appreciate it.
All right, we're going to head to the Bay Area. Let's listen to Maya Unagi, Deep Red.
Yeah.
Did you cast a spell on me, boy? I can't get away from you. I'm inside out and tongue-tied and high.
And this song is just like romantic and sultry. It's like silk.
It's so gorgeous. I also gotta say, this is a video that is a must watch for me. It's very immaculately staged. You've got Maya Unagi in the middle in her beautiful bright red suit. You've got Tariq Mujeres bright red bass in the back. It's perfect. And so is this song. It's so effortless, but at the same time, there's like a run that she does near the middle that displays like this amazing vocal control. Like, I'm a singer as well. I've done my fair share of riffs and runs. It is so easy to just sort of slide up or slide into the notes. These are all perfectly modulated and in the midst of just such an easygoing, like languid song, you just see so much technical ability.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic to listen to. It's such a treat.
It is such a treat. We're going to continue with the treats. Yes. We're going to get to number three, The Little Army, and the song is titled 2021. This brings me back to my 20s when I was listening to bands in LA and when iPods still existed. You can definitely rock out to this one.
I love this one. I actually was looking at their live pre-pandemic videos. They used to play at Armadillo out in Davis. And the song is not a happy song, but you can't really tell right away. It's so energetic, so upbeat. The Little Army is three members, but they've got such a big sound. Yeah. And while listening to this, I just got really nostalgic for, you know, sweaty apartment shows, exactly. The guy sort of screaming at the top of his lungs, someone hit their head on like the awning, stuff like that. I really am really happy that live music is coming back.
Me too. And you brought us an extra. This is Acorn. They're from Napa and it's called Observer Effect. Let's take a listen.
Open the computer, Google my diagnosis. Smoking slows the healing, but my mind might reverse it. Caught in Ouroboros as my body reposes. Everything is poisonous and high enough.
This is such a cozy song, not to mention Acorn is a pretty visual band name.
It is, and it's spelled E-G-G-C-O-R-N. It's like got a fun little double the fun in it. This is a very cozy song. I would not mind if Acorn read me bedtime stories, but the message of the song is really, really hits home for me. Right. It's about like, so she wrote it while she was recovering from like a broken leg, and she was reading up all the ways you can like mess up your healing, and then realized, if I'm worrying about this all the time, isn't this worse for me? And so she says that Observer Effect is a song about like imbibing your vices, thinking about the small pleasures in life. And I think that is something that has grounded me a lot in the last couple of years, just thinking of the little joys we have and most importantly, to be kind to yourself.
Just cutting ourselves some slack. Thank you so much, Jasmine.
Yeah,
this was
you.
A ton of fun. On that note, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.